Hi, this is Charles on democraticfundamentalism.org with the news in review. It's Sunday, November 3rd, 2002, about midnight Pacific Coast time. I think I have some very interesting stories for you this time about some issues you really care about and probably going to continue to be neglected. I'll talk a little bit about the imperatives of the elections on Tuesday, all the while George Bush and Bill Clinton and Al Gore have hit the campaign trails on behalf of their candidates. I think I've been able to piece together some stories to make the case for the real neglect by the Bush administration to the principles of this nation and the people of this country and its responsibilities to the people and nations in the rest of the world, too. Heck, I'll heap it on. Throw in a little bit of hypocrisy, too, to top it off. Got a quick little story about an evening I spent once with a woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize. The thing I love about powerful women is they always leave you wondering if you're really doing everything you can do for whatever you believe in. I love that kind of challenge. It sort of makes you wonder if you're a little inadequate sometimes, if you know what I mean. Got some entertainment news, too, about a new baby arriving in the world to some longtime favorite stars, and a story about the amazing Christopher Reeve. First, as always, I want to welcome those of you linking into democraticfundamentalism.org from other sites. Let you know that we have links inside the text of this broadcast to more in-depth coverage of what I talk about. Just go to democraticfundamentalism.org and select the News in Review from the front page, and you'll be able to find it from there. As I always say, you don't have to take my word for anything, because I don't have to make this stuff up. Second, I want to take a quick opportunity to commend CNN for doing an exceptional job on the election coverage. I really mean that. For those who follow this broadcast, you know I never hesitate to recommend CNN, and I don't get anything by recommending them, other than knowing you'll get an intellectually honest report from them, whether you go to their website or watch them on the air. Third, I want to remind you, really, how important it is to vote, even if you're not a Democrat. I mean that. When a lot of people vote, it means that the will of the people truly gets expressed, and that the policies and practices of this nation will be implemented and represented. I urge you to get out and vote on Tuesday and to become someone who reminds other people and helps them to get out and vote themselves. The future of this country, your future, really, your future depends on it. Don't forget that. This message was brought to you by a guy who's uncompromisingly committed to democracy. With that said, let's get into the news. Well, folks, you're getting out on the campaign trail. This is from CNN. President Bush opened a hectic Saturday in a three-day weekend of interstate stumping for GOP candidates with a rally near Nashville, Tennessee. He and other high-profile figures from both major parties, including Bill Clinton and Al Gore from the Democratic side, are crisscrossing the country in the last three campaign days before Tuesday's midterm election. Former President Bill Clinton, who seemed almost as busy campaigning as when he ran for office, went to Michigan Friday to promote the candidacy of Jennifer Granholm, who hopes to win election as that state's first female governor, as well as Democratic candidates for the House and Senate. Clinton praised the diversity of the state's Democratic candidates. He said, "It's an American ticket." Clinton blamed Republicans as he spoke about the economy, pointing to job losses, a struggling stock market, and corporate scandals. "We have the chance to balance the ideological extremism of the Washington Republicans," Clinton said. Now, you know, what I find interesting is how George Bush is going around telling people that a vote for the candidates he's campaigning for is a vote for his administration's policies. And he trivializes discussions of political interest among citizens by calling it coffee house chatter. Seems like he'll do anything to minimize the feelings and opinions of Americans to cause them to blindly accept his rhetoric as the truth, you know, as like the way it is. So I thought I would bring you a few stories that tell a little more about what the Bush administration's policies really are. I'll also point out in the condemnations of Iraq, Bush and company repeatedly pointed out that Iraq didn't honor its commitments to the United Nations and the world. Keep in mind that as we go along and decide if we're facing hypocrisy ourselves. Remember, in the eyes of the world, the acts of our government reflect upon how we are viewed as individuals and as people. Ask yourself if these stories represent what you want to be known for, and what your country to be known for. First, remember Florida? You know, they just can't seem to run an election. And here we are with a tight race for the governorship. And sound familiar? Now the reports are coming in. This from CNN. Florida's early voters encounter delays. Even before election day, some Florida voters are finding that their state's elections are still beset with problems. I think it's crazy what's going on here with delays, said one voter in Broward County, where people who rushed to the polls to take advantage of the state's new early voting routine ran into the same kind of gridlock they recently have been finding on election day. You wait for an hour, and there's only two ladies checking you in. They were very courteous and seemed to know what they were doing, but there were only two of them. In the wake of the state's much-criticized role in the 2000 presidential election debacle, the Florida legislature last year amended a law that had required people wanting to cast their ballots early to certify they could not go to the polls on election day. Now, any registered voter can vote as early as 2 weeks before Election Day at any of limited numbers of polling booths set up in populous Broward and Miami-Dade counties, key to Democratic hopes of victory in Bill McBride's campaign to unseat GOP Governor Jeb Bush. As many as 100,000 voters were expected to cast pre-Election Day votes, but long lines were the order of the day Thursday and Friday, particularly at the six polling places set up in Broward County, with early birds waiting up to 2 hours to cast their ballots. At the courthouse in Plantation, seven polling machines were no match for the hordes of voters, many of them drawn by a tight midterm race for governor. The problem? An 11-page ballot filled with wordy state and local issues on everything from schoolroom class size to whether pregnant pigs can be confined. Voters who have not familiarized themselves with the ballots prior to entering the polling booth may need up to 15 minutes to wade through the gobbledygook, experts said. It will take time, said Joe Cotter, Broward County Election Supervisor. If voters don't prepare, it will be a problem. George Bush and company have been the ones identified as helping the common citizen with tax breaks that make little or no difference to the quality of life. Now stock analysts are excited because corporations are reporting higher profitability and think it's leading to a new surge in the market, and it very well might in the market because it will be an artificial rise just like before. The profit increases are based on layoffs and depletions of inventories. It's not because of greater productivity. The corporations on paper may look better, but citizens are struggling to make ends meet. We simply call it hard times, but we fail to recognize that economic conditions are actually worse than in 1929, at the time of the stock market crash. That's the part that's being glossed over and ignored by the Bush administration. Remember, 60% of Americans live under or near the poverty line. Now ask yourself, is money getting tighter in your household? How secure do you feel about your job and your retirement? This story from the New York Times, it's about how job losses continued in October. The economy lost jobs in October for the second consecutive month, the government said yesterday in a sign that economic growth, after accelerating over the summer, has recently slowed to a crawl. The unemployment rate rose slightly last month to 5.7%, and the nation's payroll shrunk by 5,000 jobs, largely because of layoffs in manufacturing and construction. Companies also cut their workers' hours for the first time since July, suggesting that large-scale hiring is unlikely in the immediate future. The report, released just days before the midterm election, provided evidence of the worst job losses in the economy during a two-year congressional cycle since 1981-82, when Republicans lost ground on Capitol Hill 2 years after the Reagan landslide. With terrorism and a possible war in Iraq occupying much of the political debate, however, the economy might not prove to be as important an issue as it has been in the past, members of both parties said. It hasn't gotten to that kind of red-hot issue yet, but the mood is one of foreboding, said Senator Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island. R. Glenn Hubbard, a top economic advisor to Mr. Bush, commented, "Things aren't getting worse, but they aren't getting noticeably better." Adding to the concerns, weekly earnings fell in October for the first time since July, and only the second time in the last year. Consumer spending already dropped 0.4% in September, the Commerce Department said yesterday, and many companies worried that spending may slow further have cut production recently. Last month, manufacturers eliminated 49,000 jobs, the 27th straight monthly cut by the sector, which now employs fewer workers than it has at any point since 1961, reinforcing a sense that the industrial sector is suffering more than it was during the summer. A survey of supply chain managers released yesterday indicated that manufacturing activity fell in October for the second month in a row. The economy has lost considerable momentum, said Chris Vavares, president of Macroeconomic Advisors, a forecasting firm in St. Louis. Well, I don't know about you, but money has gotten a whole lot harder to find since Bush took office, and I haven't seen him do a single thing to remedy the problem. But we'll move on. Now, we get to the part where I suggest you inquire, along with me, about what messages our government is sending to the rest of the world regarding what kind of a global neighbor we are. And at a time when we condemn countries like Iraq and North Korea for not honoring their commitments, and Bush tries to embarrass the United Nations in schoolyard bully tactics to force them to give him authority to attack Iraq, well, take a listen to these stories, and then decide if Bush and company are accurately representing the will of the people of the United States. And remember, your opinion counts. This story from the New York Times: the U.S. may abandon support of UN Population Accord. The Bush administration, embroiling itself in a new fight at the United Nations, has threatened to withdraw its support for a landmark family planning agreement that the United States helped write 8 years ago. The reason for the threat is contained in two terms that the administration contends can be construed as promoting abortion. The terms, reproductive health services and reproductive rights, figure in the final declarations of the United Nations Population Conference in 1994 in Cairo, which embraced a new concept of population policy based on improving the legal rights and economic status of women. The declaration has been endorsed by 179 nations. During a population and development conference in Bangkok this week, the American delegation announced that Washington would not reaffirm its support for the Cairo Program of Action unless the disputed words were changed or removed, United States and United Nations officials said. The threat startled members of the delegations attending the Asian and Pacific Population Conference and drew immediate criticism from Chinese, Indian, and Indonesian officials who argued that the American position would undermine a global consensus on population policy, according to the United Nations officials. The threat has also elicited a sharp response from some Europeans. I think it's disappointing and incredible, said Agnes van Ardenn, the Dutch Minister for Development Cooperation. Poverty reduction will not be successful without reproductive health and without women being able to make their own choices. Congressional Democrats and United Nations officials underscored these concerns today, saying that a decision by the administration to withdraw support for the Cairo program would undermine the efforts of family planning officials in countries that have looked to the United States to take the lead in checking population growth. The impact of these public statements is devastating and could undermine 10 years of work, Representative Carolyn Maloney, Democrat of New York, said in a draft letter to the Secretary of State Colin Powell. She began circulating on Capitol Hill today. It's likely that repressive countries will follow the U.S. in its decision, and the progress that has been made will cease. The 1994 conference was widely considered a watershed event because it moved away from traditional ideas of family planning and embraced the idea that giving women more control over their lives would provide a check against explosive population growth. The program of action called for stabilizing the world's population at no more than 9.8 billion by 2050, and it urged countries to make healthcare widely accessible, reduce maternal mortality, provide universal access to primary education, and stem the spread of HIV and AIDS. The program also suggested that where abortion is legal, it should be made safe. We certainly approve any effort by the administration to make it clear that abortion is not an acceptable method of family planning, Mr. Johnson said. There is sort of code used in some of these UN documents, and groups that advocate expanded access to abortion do construe these phrases to include abortion. The dispute over the Cairo program is only the most recent example of administration efforts to withdraw American support from United Nations programs that it contends promote abortion. In July, the administration decided to withhold $34 million in previously approved aid to the United Nations Population Fund, contending that the agency helps Chinese government agencies that force women to have abortions. In May, during the United Nations General Assembly's special session on children, the Bush administration, the Vatican, and some Muslim countries unsuccessfully pushed for a policy to prevent teenagers from getting abortions. The group also sought to make abstinence the centerpiece of sex education for unmarried teenagers. The reaction would be very negative, Mr. Worth added, at a time when the administration is trying to put together international coalitions on various efforts. And still, the administration spends millions on TV ads in foreign countries to play propaganda to tell them how compassionate and friendly we are. One night I went to a banquet for a nonprofit organization committed to global poverty abatement, and they decided I was the appropriate person to sit next to and have discussions with someone named Betty Williams, who just happens to be the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in bringing peace to Northern Ireland. In addition, she's done an incredible amount of work in the area of securing children's rights around the world. I remember being incredibly moved by her stories of how she worked with Mr. and Mrs. Gorbachev to deliver toys and books to children in the Soviet Union who had never seen them before, to give shoes and clothing and medicine to children in many countries, as well as to find ways to be sure they were protected and cared for, regardless of the condition of their home life. What I found most interesting, though, was something she nearly insisted I should do, something she almost was disturbed about, the fact that there were no true publications devoted to telling people about the good and inspiring things that occur in the world. And I informed her of, numerous programs and publications I went about that attempted it, but died out as soon as a major international crisis occurred because people didn't give a lot of concern for the good things. They kind of took that for granted. They didn't worry about it. And what they concentrated on was their anxiety about the bad things. Then it takes them away from actually doing the good things they would want to do in order to give to other people. You know, she's not the kind of woman who takes no for an answer, and I ended up sort of sheepishly promising her to find a way to do it if I could. But then I see stories like this, as the U.S., my government, apparently disagrees with me and the rest of the world again. Headline on this one, the U.S. declines to sign the Children's Treaty. UN official urged the United States to ratify a treaty protecting the rights of children, an act he said would inspire the world to go the extra step for its youngest citizens. Jacob Doak, chairman of the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, called on the United States to join with 191 countries that have already signed the 1989 Convention on the Rights of the Child because it would really help the world. That ratification creates momentum and inspires non-governmental organizations and governments to go the extra step to realize the right of a child to a decent standard of living, to address poverty, child abuse, and neglect, the problem of street children, Doak said. It would really help the world if the U.S. would join the international community. The treaty lays down basic rights for all children to food, shelter, education, and protection from abuse and exploitation. Doak issued the message, along with an expression of concern about the war in Afghanistan's heavy toll on children, during a speech Friday night hosted by St. Louis University. Doak, a family and juvenile law professor at the Free University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, spoke at the International Law School Students Association Fall Conference. The United States is one of only two countries, the other is Somalia, that has not ratified the treaty. The Clinton administration signed the convention but never submitted it for Senate ratification because a number of groups argued it infringed on the rights of parents and was inconsistent with state and local laws. The Bush administration has taken no action. The Bush administration makes it pretty clear about its stance that global warming is a lie, nothing but hype. That's what they really say. Just go to, they say that. Go to heritage.org and find out for yourself. They refuse to do anything in this country to make the air cleaner or to deal with the coming water crisis. They want to make laws to promote the practice of clear-cutting forests, let alone making extra profits off the larger trees of old-growth forests. They withdrew from the Kyoto Accord, and now they decline to cooperate with other nations on the environment again. I will simply assert once again that this government does not represent my views, nor most Americans. Ask yourself, what do you believe? This story from CNN, Nations Approve Climate Change Draft, the United States does not. Rich and poor nations agreed Friday on a compromise declaration on global climate change, unable to adopt a resolution that included a deadline to limit the emission of harmful gases from vehicles and industries. After a delay of more than 8 hours that saw last-ditch efforts to avert the collapse of the UN-sponsored climate change talks, environment ministers from 169 countries approved a revised draft of the Delhi Ministerial Declaration. It provides a new direction to our common approach to combat climate change, T.R. Balu, the conference president and India's environment minister, told reporters. The conference was held to thrash out final details of the 1997 Kyoto Protocol on global warming, expected to take effect early next year after ratification by Russia. After sustained stonewalling from China, India, and other developing countries, the declaration dropped the demands of wealthy nations that developing countries initiate dialogue to make further commitments after the enforcement of the Kyoto Protocol. Instead, the declaration said the parties that have ratified the Kyoto Protocol strongly urged parties that have not already done so to ratify it in a timely manner. The declaration recognized Africa as the region suffering the most from the impact of global climate change. It agreed to move forward to curb the emission of F-gases or climate-harming refrigerants. The pact also made the Kyoto Protocol's clean development mechanism fully operational. The Kyoto Protocol also calls on about 40 industrialized countries to limit or reduce emission of greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide from industry and vehicles, blamed for raising the Earth's temperature. The accord assigns each country a target and sets an average 5.2% emission reduction from 1990 levels to be achieved by 2012. So far, 96 countries have ratified the treaty. The United States and Australia have withdrawn, however, claiming the treaty would harm their economies. KP is costly, ineffective, and unfair. It is also impractical and unrealistic. Climate change is a global phenomenon, but the developing countries are not participating, U.S. Undersecretary of State Paula Dobrianski said Friday. The United States faced criticism for not ratifying the protocol. As rising seas, increased droughts, floods, and diseases like malaria keep costing millions of dollars in lives, people around the world will not forget that the USA has continuously obstructed international efforts to prevent dangerous climate change. That from Steve Sawyer, Greenpeace Climate Policy Director. Well, frankly, I think I've made the case that the Bush administration not only ignores the responsibility of the government to tend to the well-being of the people, but it's also presenting the United States to the world as a bully, domination-motivated nation that refuses to agree to anything that would tend to take away an economic advantage. See, the truth is, what's going on is not about governing people. It's about the completion of an economic war. It's about how big business has turned our government into its representative in order to take control of the resources of this planet, the mortal detriment of many people and many nations. Selling what they're doing to us as securing our future and making us prosperous, while the ones getting prosperous are the people of the corporations that defraud us and strip us of our savings. And so when you ask yourself, what kind of example and image does our government set to the world by the way it supposedly governs this nation, ask yourself if that's how you want yourself and America to be known. My bet is that when you answer the question, you'll understand a little more about why animosity toward America by other nations is growing. I know many Americans whose animosity toward America is growing. Well, let's see, entertainment news, something on a little brighter note. I'm still waiting to find a copy of Santana's Shaman CD. I'm really anxious to hear it, but I haven't been able to find a copy of it yet. Notice Elton John has new greatest hits collection out. That's from 1970 to 2002. Frankly, if I didn't already have everything he's ever done, I'd buy it. If you're looking for some good TV, don't forget Everwood on WB Monday nights at 9 p.m. It's a family show, but it's got great writing and storylines. I really like it. For some hilarious political satire, you check out Jon Stewart on Comedy Central's Daily Show. He's doing some nightly election reports. They're on at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. Here's something kind of neat. Sarah Jessica Parker of HBO's Sex and the City and her husband, Matthew Broderick, have had a child, 6-pound, 8-ounce son, last week. And they've decided to name him after Matthew's father. His son's name? James Wilk Broderick. Just for the fun of it, I thought I'd do a little 6 degrees of separation thing on Sarah Jessica Parker and the show Sex and the City. If you follow the show, and I generally do, that and The Sopranos and 6 Feet Under, anyway. On Sex and the City, there was this guy who was Sarah's boyfriend for a while named Aiden. Now, Aiden is John Corbett. He's an actor who played the disc jockey in a little town in Alaska, fictitiously known as Sicily, Alaska, on the TV show Northern Exposure. John Corbett is the star of the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which I highly recommend. Incidentally, he's also the voice of the GE Financial ads you see on TV from time to time. Just thought I'd mention it. Personally, I thought Matthew Broderick in Project X was a great movie, too. Anyway, moving on, as I do sometimes, finally. Getting to know Christopher Reeves. Well, he seems to be able to wrangle the celebrities pretty well. Actor Christopher Reeve knows how to get to fellow celebrities, it seems. As a consultant to the upcoming PBC series Freedom, he wanted well-known actors to provide voices for characters from American history. But if he went through managers, publicists, or agents, Reeve knew he'd get some brush-offs. So he wrote to the celebrities themselves. He assembled an impressive list, too. Jennifer Aniston, Michael Caine, Sean Connery, Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, Tom Hanks, Robert Redford, Meryl Streep, Kevin Spacey, Robin Williams, and many, many others. Reeve, he's 50 years old now. He wanted to participate because his half-brother, a teacher in rural Vermont, had such trouble interesting his students in history. The kids don't want to read, they don't want to write, and sometimes the kids and their parents get so upset because they have too much homework, he said on Thursday. The series narrator, Katie Couric, said she hoped the series would encourage children and their parents to talk about history. One of the actor voices, Susan Sarandon, had a surprise for Reeve. At a news conference at the Rainbow Room, she said the actors had donated their $1,000 fees to the Christopher Reeve Paralysis Foundation. The gifts were matched by corporate sponsors, so the foundation got a $100,000 check. Now see, that's the sort of thing Betty Williams would like to have heard. Good news, you know. Best news of all, though, how about a huge turnout at the polls on Tuesday? That would be the best news of all. Don't forget to remind your friends and family. Go ahead, be a pest. It's a worthy cause. They'll get over it. With all that, we'll call it a wrap. This is Charles, DemocraticFundamentalism.org. You have a great one.